Health and Social Services Committee to order. It is 8:32, Monday, April 12th. Please let the record reflect that we have four members in attendance so far, Representative Wilson, my co-chairman, Representative Keller, Bob Heron, and Representative Sisna. Today's meeting is teleconference. Public testimony is scheduled. If you have a cell phone, please turn it off. Today, we have one item on the agenda, Senate Bill 10 by Senator Betty Davis, an act requiring health care insurers to provide insurance coverage for medical care received by a patient during certain approved clinical trials designed to test and prove prevention, diagnosis, treatment, or palliation of cancer, directing the Department of Health and Social Services to provide Medicaid services to persons who participate in those clinical trials and relating to experimental procedures under the state plan offered by the Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. We do not attest, you know, there may be, but we do not anticipate any more HESS meetings this session. If there are, it'll be under a 24-hour rule. Joining us this morning is Representative Bob Lynn and Representative Paul Seaton. Senator, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. First of all, to the chairs of the committee and all the members of the committee, I appreciate you hearing this bill at this time of morning. I know that there's a busy schedule, and so it's great that you are able to be here this morning. However, this bill has been sitting in the committee for quite some time, and I had wished that it had gotten early hearing. I'm actually very anxious to get this bill out of this committee because it does have another committee of referral, and you know, I would hope that it would get scheduled to be heard on the floor on your side for a vote. I don't have a whole lot of things that I think we have all the answers to any questions that you might have, and there should be some people online that will be willing to testify also. I would like to not have any amendments added to this bill because it could slow the process down to the point that the bill won't pass. And the one amendment that I've seen out there is an amendment that would gut this bill the way that it is written, because it would take away the fundamental principles of the bill. But I don't want to discuss that at this time. I just want to say to you that I believe that this is something that is very worthwhile to patients in our state. And I just want to share with you just a brief story, personal story, about my take on clinical trials. 5 years ago, my husband was diagnosed with cancer. And when they diagnosed it, they said he was in stage four. And we didn't think that was a bad thing in the sense that we thought, well, if he could have surgery, everything probably would be all right because they could remove the tumor. But once the surgeon was scheduled and then they checked him, they found out it couldn't be removed. It was in a spot where it could not be removed. It was on each side and they couldn't get to it. So the other alternatives was that he'd have to have some other form of treatment. And if he didn't get that lump removed at that time, they said within 6 months he would not be here. But my husband was hopeful, and so was I, because we felt that there were plenty of things out there that probably would be able to help him reach the goal of having that tumor removed. And so we chose an oncologist simply because I knew her through my church, and I'd heard about her work. And she called us in, and she talked to us and told us what the options were. And she had trained at MD Anderson, which is a medical, cancer medical center down in Houston. And she said that they had some of the best services there, and if we were interested in going there, that's what she would recommend. But it'd be up to us to decide. And she told us what our options were as far as the chemotherapy, and she told what it would do if it worked. And if he wanted to have it here, she would accommodate him and treat him here. But her advice was to go there. But my husband chose to stay here. And so they started the chemotherapy, and we thought that it was working because the tumor did shrink. But by that time, it had gotten out of the just the lung capacity, but it had gotten onto his liver. And that was a clinical trial that they said he might qualify for. And my husband was in good health at that time. That was one of the requirements, that you have fairly good health. And so we went there, and we waited 6 weeks. He did not make the cut, and we had to come back to Alaska. By the time that they called him back for the clinical trial, he was not eligible because his health had gone to the point where they said he wouldn't be able to do the trial. And so I have an invested interest in having this here so that other people might be able to get the treatment they need right here in the state and not have to go outside. And I don't have to tell you the story of what happened on that, because most of you probably already know that my husband did pass, and he did pass within the 6 months. I do believe if he had gotten the treatment that was preferred, that he might have lived, but that's not for me to determine. That was up to the Lord to decide. But I do know one thing: after my husband found out that he couldn't be the way he was before he had the cancer, he just pretty much just give up. And at that point, you know, it was just a matter of just treating him. But my husband lived, he lived to be 69 years old. He was looking forward to being 70, and we thought he'd live a long life. We never know. I never thought I'd live to be 71, but here I am sitting here in front of you, 71 years old, and I'm still kicking. You know, we don't know where we're going to go, because I thought I would be dead by 60 at least. You never know. But I just want you to be cautious of what this can do for other people. It didn't help my husband, but it could help many others. And as I said, I definitely would like to see this bill moved out of this committee today so that it would have an opportunity to go to the next committee or referral. And as far as I'm concerned, I would not like to have any amendments added to this bill. And that's all I have to say at this time.
Thank you, Senator Davis. Little housekeeping. Representative Holmes has joined us several minutes ago, Butch. And then, Butch, for the record, show that Representative Carl Gatto is in the audience, and he has signed up to testify. John Sherwood of the department is available for questions. Linda Hall from the Division of Insurance is available for questions. And then we have three people signed up, Representative Carl Gatto and two other people that are on the off-nets. So is before we go to testimony, is there questions for the sponsor, Representative Wilson?
I have one question. If the clinical, the trial is one of those options, and there is a complication with the trial, does it fall back underneath the insurance, take care of any kinds of complications, or does it fall underneath the people who are giving the trial?
You know, I prefer to let the professionals answer that, because I'm not able to for certain to know the answer to that. But we do have people online that could answer that.
No problem. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions for the sponsor before we go to testimony? Seeing none. Okay. We have an additional person that is signed up on the off-net. So we have a total of three people on the off-net. And then, of course, the department personnel that I've already mentioned are available for questions. At this time, I'd ask Representative Carl Gatto to come forward and testify. Good morning, sir. If you could place yourself on the record.
Representative Carl Gatto, District 13, Palmer.
Please go ahead.
Chairs and committee members, I think I have more answers than questions. I've been doing this for 10 years. There was one question about who pays. There is about a 30-page document you sign when you take a clinical trial, and it says, you know, if everything goes south, we'll take care of you until you're back to okay. And there's some issues in clinical trials that are probably important to know. It's probably cheaper to have clinical trials and discover good medicine than to care for somebody for a dozen years. Very expensive medical care. So let me tell you a short story about clinical trials and why I decided to come in and testify. Like I said, I have a lot of answers. There's an interesting drug. Its name is ipilimumab. I know, it's hard to pronounce. So I had to work at it. You look it up on the website. It's MDX-010. And so there are a lot of code names for it. But here's the story. They ran a trial on ipilimumab, and they had several hundred people. And during the trial, maybe a year into it, there were several cancers involved. Five people said, I don't want to continue. Probably worried, you know, half the people are not receiving the medication. They're in the placebo group. So five people just said, I'm out. I'm going to go see my doctor. I want surgery. So they went to surgery. And before, by the way, I got to back up a little bit. Before the trial, you have to have a visible lesion. There's nothing to measure if we don't start out with a disease that's seen and measured and then see if the trial causes the disease to shrink or go away or something. So five people bugged out of the trial. They went to surgery. Two of the people, in surgery, the doctor said, paraphrasing, what the heck happened? This area had cancer and it's missing. This area had cancer and it's so little, they would have never qualified for the trial. Three people, there was no report. My guess is the three people, two of them must have been the placebo group anyway, because that's the way the trials run. So clinical trials can, not commonly, but can produce a medicine that works. The alternative is to do chemo maybe more than once, to take drugs, all of which are usually pretty expensive. And they don't seem to affect a cure. They sort of are good at delaying death rather than affecting a cure. So I brought up this one drug because it's a story that was published in journals. And I knew the doc beforehand. He's in California, high-end doc. So I want to help Betty talk about clinical trials. I mean, she lost her husband. We were looking for the last ray of hope, and that's usually a clinical trial. And as you know, by the time you reach that, they only take people that are pretty sick. Otherwise, it's hard to measure. So I've been in one clinical trial, and there are some nasty results sometimes. In the one clinical trial I was in, is a drug called CTLA-4, and it's cytotoxin, lymphocyte, antigen-4, and it's a monoclonal antibody. That's what you're after. It's to rev up your own immune system. And I was in it as one of the members, and they said, hey, we got to stop. One of your colleagues, his blood platelet count dropped to so low, we put him in intensive care. I said, well, how's mine? They said, yours is normal, but too bad. Trial's over. I said, okay. Because I was having some measurable success. So we have places to look. Oh, by the way, that same drug is back up now, having been modified slightly, and it has... it's involved, it's connected with the first study I talked about, the ipilimumab study. In fact, my oncologist called me one day and she said, I have a drug here that I'd like you to consider. And I said, what is it? She said, I knew you'd ask me that. And when she told me, I said, spell it. She said, oh my gosh. So I had to learn myself how it's spelled. But the point is that maybe if I were just starting out right now and ipilimumab was successful, there would be 10 years of time when I didn't have to spend, we have insurance, spend all that money on care. So in essence, clinical trials are a way to essentially, in some cases, save money. And in most cases, it's a lot better life if you can have a successful clinical trial. And I think that's the direction the country is going with the new healthcare law. I don't know how that affects us, but I do know that clinical trials are pretty good, with the one exception that they don't take people that aren't clearly sick. So at this point, Mr. Chairman, I'll I'll be happy to entertain questions.
Representative Wilson?
So this bill's talking about routine care. Is routine care just at the beginning, before you start the trial, or would routine care be throughout? I mean, I'm really trying to wrap myself around what the bill does and doesn't do, and yeah. So routine care to me is such a broad...
Well, the companies like Squibb, who was the one that manufactures this one drug, pretty much know that it's very expensive to run trials. And what they like is for people to have insurance. And they will supply the drug for free and the administration for free and the monitoring for free. But before you can get into the program, usually you have to do things like CT scans, bone scans. And they like it if you have insurance. That's your insurance, and have them pay for that to keep the cost down, because these are billion dollar drugs by the time they get them, if not more. You know, it takes years and years and maybe more than $1 billion. So routine care is, let's say I'm on this drug, and I say, well, I've got a headache now, go see my doctor, wonder if it's related to the drug. Well, they would rather I went to my doctor and he said, no, you've got a knot on the side of your head from running into the doorway, or who knows. So that's the routine care. It's difficult to know because you sign a lot of pages, a lot.
Follow-up, sir?
Representative Wilson.
I guess that's what my issue is how do we expect the doctor, your primary care physician, to know the difference between it being a routine care because it could be due to something else versus it has something to do with the medication that you're on?
Well, the doctor that becomes your routine doctor is the doctor who's in the program that administers the drug. That's your doctor. So he knows you as his, you know, that's not my original doctor, but it's the doctor that's involved in the program. So maybe you have to take a drug once a week or once a month or three times in a row and then 3 weeks off. He keeps track of everything, and then yes, you come in for routine care. That is, I want to see what the drug is doing. So we're going to do a complete blood count. And all of a sudden in the complete blood count, your white cell count is 10 times normal. Or maybe it's half normal. That's your routine care. Now, who pays for that? I can't tell you, but I'm guessing the bill is trying to get our insurance company to pay for it. Is that what the bill says?
Thank you.
Representative Keller, you have a question for Representative Mercado?
Thank you for testifying, Carl. So I think you just answered it. You don't really know how much insurance paid versus how much the pharmaceutical companies paid in your case, right?
Usually, through the chair, Representative Keller, usually what happens if you don't have an ability to pay, they don't deny you the trial. They're looking for, I think this one drug has 100 locations in the USA and probably 100 more overseas. And so it's pretty involved, but think about all the variety of patients they get. But they're either recruiting, or recruiting is closed, and once recruiting is closed, then Dr. A would say, I've got 100 patients, Gatto is one of them. And he likes me because I'm more involved than a lot of people. A lot of people will simply say, I don't know what to do, Doc, help me out. But I've read more stuff than I...
Representative Keller.
Just a follow-up for the committee. I passed out the state insurance plan. It's just kind of interesting to see. But on page 62 and 63, I don't think that you'll find any definitive answers. I'm not trying to make a point. It just is very interesting to look at the insurance standards that we have for the state.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Davis.
I don't know if he's speaking to the person that's testifying at this point, but I would like for you to at least listen to the people that are online that are professionals that can answer the questions that you have, rather than us just depend on the person that's testifying at this time. Yeah. There are a lot of answers that they can give, and I know that he's personally involved and can give a lot of answers, but I don't think he should have to be the one to bear the brunt of the professionals' opinions that they might want to give.
And it's my hope that the questions will be repeated for others that are signed up to testify, which is now on the off-net, is up to five, plus Representative Sisna has signed up to testify. So I think we've got opportunities to, for those questions to be repeated again.
Sure.
Anything else, Representative Gatto?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and if there is, I mean, if you got things, other things to do, your office is right there. We might come and get you if there's something else. And Representative Sisna, we have five people to sign up. Is it okay if you yield to those, and then you can testify after that?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Okay, let's go on the off net, and we have five people to sign up. And again, John Sherwood and Linda Hall are available for questions at any time. So on the off net, Latha, are you available?
Hello?
Yes, good morning. Could you please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony on Senate Bill 10?
My name is Latha Subramanian. I'm a medical oncologist, and I'm testifying on behalf of Denali Oncology Group, which is the Alaska State affiliate of American Society of Clinical Oncology, as its current president. I'm also testifying on behalf of all my patients who wanted to but were unable to participate in clinical trials as their insurance declined to cover for the routine patient care costs should they enroll in clinical trials. And I'm testifying on behalf of myself because I care about cancer care in Alaska. Firstly, I want to express my gratitude to both co-chairs and the members of the committee for holding this hearing. We've been waiting a long time for this. I strongly support passage of SB 10 as cancer is a deadly disease even in 2010. Our guidelines through National Comprehensive Cancer Care Network, which is our evidence-based medicine, strongly recommends treatment under clinical trials for patients diagnosed with cancer. Due to insurers' denial to pay for routine patient care costs when patients participate in clinical trials, patients obviously decline to do so. Yet the same insurers will pay for routine patient care costs when patients are treated outside of clinical trials. And this basically answers one of the questions that was raised about, does routine patient care costs occur only when patients are outside of clinical trials? It does not matter. As long as a patient has cancer and is under the care of an oncologist, they need care, whether they are getting treated under a clinical trial, outside of a clinical trial, with no chemotherapy, wherever, if it's for symptoms alone, they still need to be taken care of. And those are the routine care that the patient receives. And that's what the insurer covers, whether the patient, if the patient is not on a clinical trial. And that's what this whole bill is about. I do understand that the major concern is cost, both to the insurers and an impact on premiums. However, all the data that has been published scientifically show that the impact on the cost of premiums due to coverage for patient routine care is less than 1%. There was one study done which showed that at Memorial Sloan Kettering, the mean total cost at 6 months for clinical trials was $30,775 as opposed to $37,000 for standard care. There are also studies that have examined cost-effectiveness outcomes on basis of clinical trials cost versus quality of adjusted life years. And most of them average this at $50,000 cost-effectiveness for quality adjusted life years. In terms of the drug that was mentioned, the ipilimumab, it is now being studied in phase 3 trials for melanoma because the survival rate has improved significantly and it is thought to double the average lifespan for patients with melanoma. So that's a very promising drug, and that has come out of clinical trials. Also want to point out that it is because of cancer clinical trials that survival in childhood cancer has improved significantly. The mortality rate has decreased by 62%. Children with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which is the commonest leukemia in children, their survival has increased from 4% to 80% due to advances in treatment made possible through clinical trials. I will close by emphasizing that the only reason for initiating SB 10 is to ensure that insurers will continue to pay for services that are consistent with the usual and customary standard of care for patients under clinical trials that would be covered if the patient did not participate in clinical trials. And I hope that answers one of the questions that was raised about what is routine care. I will stop here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. We do have a question from Representative Keller.
Thank you, Doctor, for taking time to testify. You commented that you know it's about cost, and I just wanted to say that I think, as far as the committee is concerned, not really. If it's the right thing to do, then we need to get it done. There's other complicating factors in this. Can you document any cases from your experience where insurance has denied routine care in clinical care?
Yes, sir. Even this year, I've had two patients who would have participated in clinical trials. One was with breast cancer, another with lymphoma, and they opted out because when the research nurse contacted the insurance company, they said they would not pay for the standard of care. And just to explain it, well, those patients are now getting chemotherapy. The insurance is paying for it, but it is being done outside of a clinical trial.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Yeah, you say that they were denied the standard of care. Was that verbal, or do we have any documentation on that at all?
Well, can I just rephrase that? They were not denied the standard of care. They were just denied. What the insurance told them was that they would not pay for the routine care. And yes, the research nurses should be able to give you more specific data.
Please.
We have research nurses who help us and the patients on clinical trials.
Follow-up, Representative Keller.
Yeah, thank you. Doctor, the confusing thing to us maybe, and we'll have the department up here later to answer the same question, I think, but there's a section of this bill that requires this for Medicaid, and the fiscal impact, as it's studied and presented to us by the department, is that it's a fiscal impact of zero. And that would indicate that Medicaid... There's a question in there trying to figure out why there's even a concern about this, and it'd be nice to be able to document cases that where care is indeed being denied. And I know I've heard stories, and I certainly maybe it's the right thing to do to demand care, but why would the insurance companies care? And we'll have the Division of Insurance up here also if routine care is already covered. So thanks.
That's just why we started this.
Okay, if you just hold on, we have another question. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, and thanks for testifying. On the two that you're talking about that were not allowed to go forward with the clinical, were these from big companies, or because, you know, we're only talking about covering it underneath Medicaid or the smaller companies. We're not talking about, you know, the big programs. So do you know what companies denied this? Or didn't allow it?
I don't remember the name of the insurance company, but the research nurses would have the answer to that too.
And follow up?
Yes, please go ahead.
And on the routine care, who decides what part of this program is routine care, therefore would be paid by the insurance company, and which ones the clinical trial people would be responsible for paying?
The routine care is the care that the patient would get normally in terms of seeing the doctor, the routine tests and x-rays that we would do for the patient if they were not on a clinical trial.
Follow up?
Because
please.
Patients need care regardless of whether they go on a clinical trial or not.
Okay, I'm going to try to rephrase. Is there a definition of routine care that of things that we would know that would fall underneath routine care?
Yes, I think most clinical trials do define it, and even somewhere in this bill it is defined what the routine patient care costs are. That is just the standard care that the patient gets. And I know there are other physicians online who may be able to answer the question now or later.
Okay, thank you.
To this person?
Yeah.
Representative Keller?
Yeah, thank you again, Doctor. The question in my mind, maybe I think you may be the right person to ask. Although, you know, I know that the answer may not be real easy to be definitive, but as I understand it, clinical trials are experimental. We call them, what do we call them? Looking for information, anyway, in the bill. And there's four phases, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And some of the states, anyway, have passed this legislation without phase 1. And I'd like to get your reaction to that. But before I go there, I wanted to point out the sponsor made reference to an amendment that gutted the bill. And that was not the intent at all. In fact, that part of it I will not offer. But the part of it that I am interested in is possibly exploring doing this for phases 2, 3, and 4. And so if you would respond about what the difference is between the different levels of clinical care, I'd be appreciated.
Well, the phase one of the initial step of studying a treatment or a drug with patients with cancer, and they do have therapeutic intent. It's after a drug is shown to be promising in the lab. And since we have advanced a lot with molecular technology, that has become even more important and significant in oncology now, because that's how some of the drugs we study now, like Tarceva or Avastin, come into general use, or even Herceptin. Phase 2 and Phase 3 clinical trials test, we know that they work in certain cancers, and we want to test if they work better than standard care, or if they have uses in other kinds of cancer than the one cancer that they were initially started for, like, say, Herceptin in breast cancer, and now it can be used in ovarian cancer or even stomach cancer. And then Phase 4 are studies that are done in a larger group of patients to see if there is toxicity, which we are not aware of by the preliminary studies. And they all have their value in cancer care.
A follow-up. There, I would assume there's a lot more Phase 1 than there are 2, 3, and 4, simply because in Phase 1, some of the processes have been found not effective or problematic, and so there may be more people in the upper phases, but the actual number of trials, I would think there'd be more in Phase 1 than the others. I just want to know if you can confirm that or not.
Actually, it's the other way around. The number of patients in Phase 1 are very small. It's usually around 10 to 20 patients before it goes to Phase 2, Phase 3, or Phase 4.
Yeah, no, you misunderstood me. I understand that. But the actual number of trials is what I'm saying. There would be, because in other words, I would imagine, here's another way of asking the question. I would assume that all Phase 1 clinical trials don't proceed to Phase 2, 3, and 4.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, but there are more Phase 2, Phase 3 trials open, even over here, than Phase 1.
Yeah, thank you.
Follow-up question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I might have misunderstood, so I'm just going to try to clarify. If I don't have insurance at all, am I not eligible to do a clinical trial?
Absolutely not. You are eligible. The only problem, if you don't have insurance, then, you know, it's like any other care that you get. So you can get any medical care if you have no insurance. The only concern is who pays for it. And majority of the time, the hospitals and the physicians write it off unless the patient, you know, pays something. But you do get, I mean, that's the significant thing about medicine is it doesn't matter where you come from, how much money you have, you always get the best care that is available. At least we physicians try to provide the best care that's available.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Seeing no other questions, thank you for your testimony. Let's move on to Dr. Anderson.
Hello, I'm on the line. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, you're loud and clear. Please put your place yourself on the record with your name, your affiliation, and begin your testimony on Senate Bill 10.
Okay, thank you. My name is Dr. Jeannie Anderson. I'm a medical oncologist in private practice at Anchorage in Anchorage. I've been involved in clinical trials in cancer for the last 20 years, initially at University of Washington and Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, then at University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. And I've been in private practice in Anchorage for the last 9 years. And I'm also currently the medical director of the Cancer Research Department of the Providence Cancer Center. I'd like to reiterate, without going into details, all the comments that my colleague Dr. Subramanian mentioned and the importance of this bill, and I think the other senators and representatives have explained the clinical benefit to a lot of people as individuals. I'd like to just jump into a few handful of points to make some clarifications. First of all, regarding Representative Wilson's question about how do we determine what is routine care, I think Dr. Subramanian gave a very good perspective as a practicing physician. I'd like to also add that what we do, I help supervise the research nurses in the Providence Cancer Center Research Department. And we do, with every protocol or research study that we open up, we go through what we call a Medicare coverage analysis. We look at all the tests that are going to be part of the clinical trial, and we go through and determine, is this routine care or not? The guidelines that we use to determine is a test like a CAT scan or a blood test considered routine care is we look at a national organization called the National Comprehensive Care Network, which is standardized guidelines that are something that the federal health bill is going to probably be using in determining what is considered standard of care. So it's a well-regulated, expert-driven system to determine what should be considered standard of care. Another point I'd like to make is one of the representatives asked about who pays for the cost of complications by a clinical trial. In the bill, it's actually insurance companies cover the cost of complications, and I'd like to clarify why it has to be that way. When a patient is enrolled on a study, they're often sick. They may or may not be getting an actual drug, for instance, or they may be getting a standard drug with or without an investigational drug. So they may be getting a standard chemotherapy, and then they're getting something that's a blinded drug, and that could be nothing, or that could be this investigational drug. When somebody has a complication, we're sort of blinded to what is the cause. Cancer patients have so many complications that we actually grade something that's happening, and we try to attribute the likelihood that it's due to this drug X, which could be placebo, could be drug X, or it could be standard drug Adriamycin that lots of cancer patients get as an FDA-approved drug. It's almost always impossible to know what's due to what. Is it due to the patient's underlying diabetes? Is it due to their underlying hypertension? Is it due to their lung cancer? Is it due to standard drug Adriamycin, or is it due to investigational blinded drug X? So it's all part of cancer care. The other thing I'd like to also emphasize is regarding phase one studies, the question is, are there more studies in phase one? There really are more studies in phase two and three, as Dr. Subramanian mentioned, because many studies are not looking at the development of a new drug being, you know, potentially going on the market from a pharmaceutical company. Many, many, many of our studies are taking standard drug, again, I'll use Adriamycin as an example, and combining it with another drug and looking at is giving it weekly versus every 3 weeks better. You know, is there less toxicity? Is there just as good an outcome? Is there a better quality of life? And things like that. So there's a myriad of different kinds of clinical trials, and I think that's one of the reasons why there's really not an increase in cost if somebody goes in a clinical trial, because they're often just variations of routine treatment that we're just trying to improve the outcome or decrease toxicity. And then the last comment I'd like to mention, last year when we were, or a year and a half ago, we were initially setting up this bill, Providence Alaska Medical Center, which is obviously a big self-insured plan in the state, excluded the coverage of enrolling on a clinical trial to their employees. Because of this bill, this large self-insured plan now does allow their employees to enroll on clinical trials. And I personally have two Providence employees who've been on clinical trials, and there has not been an increase in cost. And they, you know, in my opinion, think they've got excellent treatment. And so I'm expecting that other self-insured plans are likely to follow suit when they understand that all we're doing is providing the same benefit that currently Medicare recipients and Department of Defense recipients also have. And I'd like to stop there and answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Doctor. Seeing no questions at this time, we'll move on to Dr. Stewart.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Mary Stewart. I have been in practice in Anchorage for 25 years doing cancer care. And Dr. Subramanian and Dr. Anderson have spoken so well, I don't want to add a lot of verbiage here because their points are well taken. But I take care of real people, people who live with cancer, people who are dying from cancer, and some people who are destined to get cancer at some point in their life. We want to do better. We want to be able to take care of people better. Clinical trials are one avenue to finding better treatments. Any barriers to clinical trials should be brought down. Insurance coverage for routine care is one of them. Please pass this bill. Thank you.
Dr. Stewart, we have a question from Representative Keller.
Dr. Stewart, greetings. I just wanted to take this opportunity to say hi, and I wanted to also use this opportunity to kind of make a statement and let you respond, but there's different perspectives of looking at this bill, and one is from the perspective of the patient. I happen to be a patient in your office, your cohort, Dr. Spencer, and so I'm not, this is not a new topic to me, and when you're faced with serious disease and death and those kind of things, that's one perspective. Another perspective that we have to deal with down here, one that it concerns us, and the reason why this is even a question is you got two huge companies, your entities. You got the pharmaceutical company and you got the insurance industry, I should say, not company but industry. And pharmaceuticals are developed at high cost and high risk to the pharmaceutical company. They put sometimes millions of dollars into developing a particular drug. And the reason they do it, looking at it from a kind of a coarse perspective, not the perspective of the patient, it isn't that I'm not sensitive to that, but looking at it in that sense, I mean, the reason they do that is because of the profits related to a finding a successful treatment. And so they put, I'm reminded of Shell Oil trying to get up here on the Outer Continental Shelf and drill. They're somewhere near $500 million invested there, very high risk, and they may lose it all if they do not come up with a permitted process. And that's kind of the model of the pharmaceutical companies, it seems to me. And then you have the insurance companies, where they make their money on policies, and they're in a very heavily regulated industry. In fact, some of the regulations pending, we can't even begin to understand from a legislative perspective yet. And what worries me, and the reason that I was hesitant on this bill from day one, is that if we get into this area at all where the insurance industry is starting to pick up some of the risk of the pharmaceutical company in developing these drugs, what are we doing to the quality of the clinical trials? The clinical trials seems like, let's just put it this way. We're messing with the market if we're not real careful. And it's hard to know what we're doing to the market when we're talking two huge industries like this. And anyway, I'd like to get your response, if you don't mind, on that, just kind of sweeping the Milky Way. But I wanted to take this opportunity to let you know and let the put on the record that it's not cold-hearted reaction here by any of us on this committee. But go ahead.
Well, the interplay between big pharma and the insurance companies is complicated, but I don't think this bill really is, because what we're talking about is insurance companies covering routine care. That's the stuff that you would do anyway. When somebody comes in to see me because they've got whatever kind of cancer it is, I'm going to do a certain number of blood tests. I'm going to do imaging, certain number of x-rays routinely, because that's what we normally do as part of the care for whatever kind of cancer it is. That doesn't go away just because someone's on a clinical trial. And this bill only asks that the routine care be covered. So the I don't think it involves really a commentary on the interplay of pharma versus insurance companies. This is just regular people getting regular care, in my view.
Representative Killer.
Yeah, just a very quick follow-up. So then you're confident that the insurance companies are denying routine care at this point?
There are some, yeah, that say if you go on a clinical trial, we're not going to cover anything, not even the regular blood counts and x-rays that you would do normally. This really does happen, and it's very sad. Not only does it deny help to those individuals, but it denies help to the people with cancer in general. The more clinical trials we have, the more answers we will get, the more people we can help, the more cancers can be cured. This is just routine care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. We have a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you for your testimony. During a clinical trial, if someone is not on the medication because they're part of that other group, does the doctor doing the care know which group that person is with?
Depends on the trial. Some are blinded and some are not.
Follow up?
Please, go ahead.
Okay, so if the person is not with, they're not getting the drug, they're getting a placebo, then we're basically asking the insurance companies to do what we're calling routine care when nothing really is being done to help them with their cancer because they're part of the other group. Is that not true?
Well, they would get checkups and office visits regularly anyway. You know, they might get them a little more often, perhaps, if they're on a trial. And so that's where those standards that Dr. Anderson mentioned through the NCCN can be used to try to determine what's routine and what's more than routine.
Follow up.
Please.
And I think in your last statement, that's where my problem here is that I don't think anybody on here is arguing routine care and they should do it. But we're looking at the ones with the drugs. They're the ones who are going to make all the money if it works. But I don't have a problem with the people who are receiving a treatment getting routine care. My concern is you have a whole other group who really are getting no care at all as the placebo group, and we're giving that extra, we're costing more money to the insurance companies to track that versus that going to the person manufacturing the drugs. Am I making a mistake here?
Well, perhaps in cancer care, in people who actually have cancer, it is very rare to have a placebo-only group, because it's considered unethical to just give a placebo to someone who has active cancer. So typically, they will be getting a standard version of care with or without the study drug. And so those individuals actually would need regular visits and checkups and blood tests and whatever, because they will typically be getting standard care. Placebo-driven trials are typically only in prevention trials to prevent cancer, and some phase one and phase two trials where a drug is being determined to whether it has an effectiveness in a certain kind of cancer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. For the committee's information, we still have John Sherwood and Linda Hall available for questions, and we'll get to them last. We have two more signed up, and then we'll ask after that if there's others who have joined us. So, Hannah Smith, are you available?
This is Hannah Bryce Smith. I'm a clinical research nurse in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm representing myself and my patients. And if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, I wrote four of the questions down that I just kind of like to make a point on, and then I'll get out of your way.
Please go ahead.
Okay. There's been a lot of questions asked about the phase one and is there more phase one trials. And what I just want to clarify is that not every drug that we are dealing with during the clinical trial processes of our patients go from phase one through phase four. Once a drug has gone from phase one through phase four with FDA, then we're open to testing it, adding other drugs into it, giving it more frequently, giving it less frequently, spreading out the time that we give it. And so that's why there's so many phase two and three trials, because twos and threes are looking at decreasing side effects and increasing the usefulness of drugs that we already know are safe and work against cancer drugs. So that's kind of why there are so many twos and threes out there. The other big point that I wanted to make is we talk so much about routine care and standard of care, and one of the physicians touched on this when she was saying that she works with the research nurses and they do a review. Routine care is based on the diagnosis and evidence-based practice. So if you are diagnosed with cancer A, evidence says you should get blood work on day 1, 5, and 10. You should get an x-ray on day 1 and day 10. There are insurance companies now that are saying, we'll pay for that blood work based on your cancer A on day 1, 5, and 10, and that x-ray on day 1 and 10 if you don't go on any clinical trial. But if you go on a clinical trial, we won't even pay for your blood work on day 1, 5, and 10 and your x-ray on day 1 and 10 because you went on the clinical trial. So we are then prejudiced against people who go on a clinical trial. Because the routine care, and Representative Wilson was asking, is there a definitive way of finding out routine care? If you go on to the national guidelines and you look up cancer A, so say small cell carcinoma of the lung, it will list what routine care is for that. And that's what we're saying, is if that is listed as a routine care for that type of cancer, irregardless of whether you are on a trial or not, you should be able to get that same treatment paid for. So the routine care is based on the diagnosis, not on the phase of the trial. The third thing was, we've gotten so caught up on the phases of the trials that we're forgetting in some ways how many different types of clinical trials are out there for cancer. There's prevention trials, symptom management trials, treatment trials, and end-of-life trials. So there are trials that look at all different aspects of cancer, not just somebody who is absolutely on the end of the spectrum. Representative Keller, you asked me to get you an insurance letter, and I raced back to Fairbanks, and I went to talk to my patient because she had told me that I could give you a copy of her insurance letter. And in the time since this bill started and I had a copy of her insurance letter, and now she has recurred with her cancer. And to me, this speaks very highly of the fear that Alaskans are living in. She burst into tears at the thought of me giving you a copy of that letter, even if I blacked out her name, for fear that out of reprisal, she would not get the care that she needs when her insurance company found out that her letter had been given to the legislature. And that breaks my heart for my patients, and I'm just going to say that. I've been an oncology nurse for 23 years. I was born and raised in Fairbanks. I've been in cancer research the last 2 years, and that's my comment.
On behalf of Representative Keller, who had to leave the room for another bill he has in another committee, he says thank you very much for your comments. Seeing no other questions, thank you for your testimony. At this time, we have two left to go. First, we'll go to Emily.
That's what I remember.
Yes, good morning to the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Emily Neenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society, and I live in Anchorage. I feel a lot of empathy for the members of the committee, because when I started looking at this issue, I didn't know much about clinical trials or how this all worked. I'm not a medical professional. I strictly work in the public policy realm, but I've learned a lot over the last couple years, and I believe that I've given all of you a copy of a summary of our positions on the bill, and I've gone back and asked, every time I've gotten questions, I've gone back to our policy team in Washington, D.C. to ask, okay, so what about this? What does this mean? During that time, and asking a lot of questions, I have learned, like what Hannah, some of the other Hannah Smith, and some of the other doctors mentioned, that there are clear standards for routine care that are based on diagnosis and don't change no matter what kind of, whether you're on a clinical trial or not. That's one thing I want to bring up. Another thing that has come up is this issue around placebos, and I think that Dr. Stewart touched on this, but just to put it in more lay terms, placebos are not used, placebos are never used solely, just a placebo in a treatment trial. If you're testing a drug, and you can ask the doctors to verify this information, but if you're testing a drug, you're often testing, say it's a chemotherapy drug, you're often testing the efficacy of, what if we have this drug, well, what if we add this other drug in on top of it? So you have your the standard drug that's accepted practice for that cancer, and then you add something else to it to see if you can mix it up and get any better results. That added piece, you may be, that may or may not be placebo, but you're still getting treated. You're never going to not get treated, because that would fall under violations of code of ethics. The other thing that I've been looking at are the market segments, and how does this really affect the market. I want to mention something that Representative Keller has brought up in the past, and just stress again that the trial sponsors pay for investigational drugs and treatments, and any research-related costs, such as data collection and analysis, but they don't pay for routine care when somebody goes on a clinical trial. So if you're uninsured and you go on a clinical trial, that's actually great, because you can get the trial to pay for a drug, but you still have your routine care to deal with, and that's where you're going to have to hope, you know, that you have the hospital and doctors willing to eat those costs, which then get passed on to the insured population, but that's another story. When we look at the what this is as far as the market segments in Alaska, it is true that the state does not regulate all insurance plans in the state. However, this group that the state does regulate is really one of the very last groups to add this coverage. So right now, Medicaid already does this as standard practice. Medicare already does this as standard practice. Military VA benefits already have this as standard. A number of the self-insured plans already have it. We mentioned Providence, to give Fairbanks Memorial credit. Banner Health does have this coverage as well. Also, a number of the federal employee health benefit plans have this coverage, so that there's a significant portion of that population as well. So this is really one of the last pieces that we're getting at. Finally, I know it isn't all about cost, but costs are significant considerations when we're looking at this kind of policy. I just want to verify again that the cost for routine care are comparable whether you're on a clinical trial or not. Those routine care costs have been found to be comparable in numerous studies, and in some cases may actually be less for routine care for somebody on a clinical trial than they were for somebody that isn't on a trial. I'd be happy to take any questions that you have, and appreciate your time and consideration of this important legislation.
Thank you, Emily, for your testimony. One question from Representative Wilson.
So the self-insured group is the ones that we're talking about, or the small businesses. We're not talking about those who have, like the Walmarts and those kind of groups who have the big plans. this bill would not cover those companies. Isn't that not correct?
Through the chair, this bill would not apply to self-insured plans as the Insurance Director, Division Director Hall has explained to me over the years when we've discussed this. Those plans are not technically insurance since there's no transfer of risk, so they are not regulated by the state. But as I mentioned, many plans already do cover this.
Follow up?
Please, go ahead.
So what I'm hearing is that some companies cover, some don't. Some of the self-insured do, some don't. Do we know how many companies in the state of Alaska do not cover routine care when it comes to cancer treatment?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I wish I knew, but I do not have that information. I'm not aware of anyone that does have particularly a good database of exactly what the self-insured plans are and are not covering. I've had to do that research just, you know, sort of company by company and try to figure out and get employees of those companies to check with their own HR departments, but I don't have that information. If it's available somewhere, I'd sure love to have it.
Thank you.
Thank you. See, no other questions for you. Emily, before we go to Representative Sharon Sisna for her testimony, is there anyone else in the room or online that wishes to testify? All right, seeing none, Representative Sisna, this is testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And my name is Sharon Sisna, and I am a resident of Anchorage, and I am also a cancer veteran. And I'm a breast cancer veteran. It was 6.5 years ago that in a routine mammogram, the potential lesion was caught, and I went for further diagnoses, and they found a lesion, and I immediately was able to get an appointment to have a mastectomy. And the day of my mastectomy, prior to my operation, there were 5 other women who had the same or similar operations. A year later, and I found this out by knowing people who knew the people that were before me, and that was in support groups that are a godsend to people who actually have gone through this and are making their way through afterwards. Half of us were still alive. So for me, one, there's a real connection here in my mind between, one, the good fortune that I had, because I did live, and two, the other personal thing about this that's really highly personal is the fact that my daughter came up for my operation, and she was extraordinarily concerned about every detail and was constantly talking to the doctors afterwards. And it was only later that I realized that she was looking at the fact that I was the first person in the family to have any kind of cancer, and that she was the next generation, and so she was the next possibility in her mind, and that she was becoming extraordinarily concerned about what she had to get ready for. So that was one of the reasons that I wanted to speak today about this, because for me right now, a lot of what this bill does is actually takes away the risk of my daughter. And I went to an oncologist, it was about, I think, a year, and it was one of the ones who spoke, as a matter of fact, after my operation. And that oncologist talked about how in a decade, and that was 5 years ago, in a decade we would be looking at a difference in cancer, and some of the testimony has really talked about that, about the fact that we're having fewer side effects, that we're really moving forward. And it's the trials, and that was the point that was made at that time. It's the trials that people are going through that are actually slowly reducing the risk for women, both right now and for the next generation, my daughter. The risk is one of those things that Alaskans face by being in Alaska. All women, but it's not just all women, all humans that are living in Alaska have been living through the change in what's happening in this state. It used to be, I think, that it was heart attacks were the number one cause of death. Now it's cancer. And in going around to the different communities I've gone to, one of the things that people are talking about is that the cancer of the people in the communities, especially the elders, and that they'd never remembered cancer. Cancer wasn't something that was talked about in the oral history of communities around the state in the first Alaskan histories. So we have risk here right now. And the one way that we're going to be able to deal with cancer, in my mind, is change lifestyle, because lifestyle is one of those one of the elements that's going to get you. Maybe having a population that doesn't live as long might help too, because it's age that's the number one danger that you're in. If you age, you're more likely to get cancer by being older. But we need to do every single thing we can. And a number of people spoke to this. We've got to make sure that we deal with and eliminate in every single way we can cancer. And I think trials are the pathway forward. And I want to, in my own case, because my body will not resist cancer, cancer is certainly a potential for me. And I would, in a heartbeat, go for cancer, and I think I would be doing a service by doing it, and I hope this bill passes. Thank you.
Representative Sisna, thank you for your testimony. Question from Representative Wilson.
I don't think anybody's arguing about that. Here's where my concern, and I'm going to pose this to you. We're talking about companies on these trials who are going to make a lot of money if these get put onto the marketplace. So my question is, whose responsibility is it to take care of these routine care? Is it the potential company who's going to make a lot of money by this new medication, or is it the insurance company to help these private companies make the money? Because that to me is what this is boiling down to. It's not whether or not I think it's important for cancer treatment. I lost a father in this, so I have a dog in this fight, absolutely. But I'm looking at this at the avenue is that we're looking at companies who will financially benefit from these trials. That's the reason they're doing them in the first place. Are we forcing smaller companies, because we're not talking about the big self-insured groups here, you know, who will have to pay these. We're talking about the small business insurance groups who are going to have to pay it, putting that responsibility on them to pay for the routine care, or should it be the responsibility of those who are going to make the potential profit? Should they cover it? That's where it is in my head. Who do you think should cover it?
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It sounded as if that was aimed at me. May I?
As the person who testified, yes.
Okay, thank you. Well, that's a really interesting question that we have in state government, and is people making profit. And actually, the people that are making profit in our state off of health, and we've got a lot of people making big profit off of health, chronic care. Chronic care is the number one place in this state where you make huge amounts of money. We don't actually have pharmaceutical companies in this state that are making a profit off of that. But if we as policymakers, and I'm not sounding like a person that just testified, but I don't mean that. If policymakers would be looking at how we safeguard our Alaskans, people will make profit off of anything. I mean, and we really shouldn't dislike the idea that make people actually make profit, because those are jobs. But what we want to do as policy, what we want our policymakers to do is to constantly keep in mind, does this benefit our people or doesn't it? And the profit is just something separate. That's not, I don't, when I'm looking at trying to keep people healthy, try to figure out whether the hospital is should be out of the picture or not, because they make the most profit. Well, they do what's necessary to keep people healthy, but they make a lot of money. Does that mean that I shouldn't want people to have hospital care? I think the money side is a separate thing. I think we want to keep people healthy.
Follow-up, sir?
Yes, please go ahead.
But this bill does not make all insurance companies take care of routine care, and that's where my issue is. We're only asking the 23% of the private industry to take on this routine care. The majority of people who are covered underneath insurance in the state of Alaska are underneath the self-insured plans, which we can't touch. So so how do you even that up of saying this group has to, but because this group's bigger and has other regulations, doesn't?
Representative Cisna, I mean, you can comment, but
I'd like to defer that comment
to Linda Hall.
I think the division of insurance person
yes.
might have a good idea.
Yeah, we'll pursue that line of questioning at that.
Perfect.
There. No one else has signed up. No one else on the off net. Okay, we'd ask John Sherwood to come up. Please place yourself on the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm John Sherwood with the Department of Health and Social Services. Simply here to answer questions on the fiscal note for SB 10. It's a zero fiscal note.
Yes. This is a question that my co-chair wanted to. So if people could turn to the fiscal note, it's obviously at zero. On behalf of my co-chair, Mr. Sherwood. Explain your zero fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, primarily it's a zero fiscal note because the state of Alaska's Medicaid program already pays for routine costs for clinical trials. Just by way of background, a number of our folks who are elderly or disabled are also on Medicare, which would be the primary payer for these costs. So probably of the people we serve who have cancer, a disproportionate of that share would fall into that Medicare group. When we looked at this policy a few years ago and looked at the potential costs, we changed our policy and now do cover the routine costs. We did not think it would be a significant expense to us. So,
thank you. Representative Wilson, you have a question for Mr. Sherwood.
Absolutely. First of all, in the title of this bill, it says that part of the reason for the bill is to provide Medicaid services to persons who participate in those clinical trials and related experimental procedures, which you're saying we already do.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay.
This bill would simply give us a statutory requirement to do it as now we do it as a matter of policy and regulation. We're not required to by statute. This bill would put it in statute so we couldn't make a policy reversal without statutory change.
Another question?
Representative Wilson.
Okay, we're trying to, we're talking about all insurance companies, not just also Medicaid. And self-insured groups, currently, we cannot mandate them to do anything because they're underneath federal laws. Is that correct?
I would defer to Director DeHall there. That's my understanding, but she's the expert.
Okay. I'll keep trying. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Sherwood? Seeing none, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Linda, we always save the best for last. Please put yourself on the record.
Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance.
Okay, we'll start with Representative Wilson. She has a question for you.
Okay, hopefully you're the right one. My understanding is only about 23% is private insured through small groups. Yeah, your little calendar thing. Yeah, I like color. So self-insured, the big companies, state as well as the Walmarts and those, currently are underneath federal law. So this would not impact them at all. Is that correct?
It's correct as far as the most of the large companies that are have self-funded plans. The state is not under federal law. That was a piece I would. The state self-funded plan is not considered to be insurance, and governmental plans are exempted from even ERISA. So the state plan really isn't regulated by anybody. But self-funded plans in general, the BPs, Alaska Airlines, those kinds of companies are regulated under ERISA by the Federal Department of Labor.
Okay, follow up.
Yes, please go ahead.
Is there any way for us to know the financial impact on the group of insurance that we are talking about if we would require the routine care underneath these treatments?
Through the chair, no, not ahead of time. I don't think there's any way to know. Typically, when I have sought answers to how much do mandates cost, and that's over a broad range of mandates over the years that I've been involved in. I've seen proposed, some have passed, some have not. We probably, as a state, have the fewest number of mandates of most states. Some states have upwards of 40. I think we have about 9. But it's not tracked by anybody to tell down to that degree of specificity to really get a cost for a mandate.
Follow up.
Please.
How hard would it be for someone to even decide, a doctor or whomever, or the insurance company? Because what I see happening is we put somebody into this treatment, and then we end up with a battle between, is this a routine care, or is this something that has to do with a drug, and the person who's giving the drug should pay for it? And now all of a sudden you've got both insurance groups fighting over who has to pay. Is it going to be very easy for the doctors to distinguish whether or not it should fall under routine care or underneath complications for the medication?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'm not sure. I mean, I just heard someone testify that routine care is defined. I'd never heard that before. I don't think we have a situation that all insurance companies deny routine care for all treatments to begin with. I think there are, and I can't give you a number. It didn't occur to me today. I suppose we could go back and go through individual health policies that are filed with us and look at who may have a specific exclusion for routine care and clinical trials. I'm not sure it's worded that way. But I know that some of the large the companies that have larger market shares in our state do provide routine care for certain phases. I understand some are not providing care for phase one specifically, maybe not phase four, but so I think you're going to have a range of things that are or not provided. The exclusion is most likely to fall under the terminology we don't pay for experimental drugs. I don't think it necessarily gets into the routine care piece, although it may. I would tell you that just as anecdotal information, I checked, as I sat here this morning, with my consumer complaint section. I was not aware that we had numbers of complaints on this issue from consumers. And I have 4 people that's all they do is work with consumers and their complaints against insurers for one thing or another. And about 50% of those are health insurance. So I emailed my supervisor and said, do you get complaints about lack of payment for routine care and clinical trials? And she said, no, not at all. So we're not getting these kinds of complaints. I'm very interested, and I've heard some testimony today that I would be interested in follow-up with people that are seeing that. Now, it may specifically be a contractual exclusion in a policy, and if so, we'll say so. But we don't get complaints. I've seen complaints about use of experimental drugs for example types of cancer that the drug was not approved for. I've seen those kinds of things, and so that truly is, it's a little different. It's just, it's a use of the drug as that's not currently approved. Alaska has what's called an external review process that requires an insurance company to have both an internal review process when they deny a claim should their policyholder disagree with the decision. They also have to do, when requested, an external review of that denial. And that external review brings in doctors, medical people who have experience in that field to review these experimental things and make determinations. And so there are procedures to do some things, unless they really are very clear policy provision against doing like the routine care for clinical trial. But there's a wide range of things that even with this bill I don't think would be clarified, so to speak, about that experimental exclusion in a policy. I think Representative Wilson referred, pardon me, Keller, I'm looking at the wrong person. Representative Keller mentioned bringing the state language in, and how clear is that? Their insurance policy language is subject to interpretation. It's often not clear. I spend my life reading it. It's still sometimes not clear, although it's quite boring much of the time. But that's what we do. We provide that technical level of expertise. So I think there are a lot of questions, and there sometimes are not good answers. So I don't think it's as cut and dried. I'm not here to debate the merits of the bill. I'm just here to try to provide a broader range of information to you as you make that policy decision.
Just one but, more question. But just so my understanding, though, earlier in your response to the question, is yes, there is no definition of routine care in the statutes, probably not in very few insurance policies. What I think the person was testifying is that if there is a certain cancer and you go to some publication, there is a, I'll use the term loosely, recommended routine. There is a definition of routine care within those recommendations by some publication. So I just wanted to put that on the record. And if a follow-up to your question, Representative Wilson.
And I'm going to try to say this a little different than I did with Representative Cisna, because to me it's not about the money on the prescriptions, but if these trials go through and they're successful with whatever the treatment is, someone is going to have great profits for doing it. I'm personally seeing this bill being one of these of, if I can make more profit over here because I can make this group pay for part of this trial, which is exactly what they would have to do if the insurance company didn't do it, to make their case go forward. I mean, it is up to the trial, the people doing the trial, to do the routine care and everything else if the monies weren't coming from anywhere else. I mean, or would you see trials just completely end if this bill didn't go through?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I can't answer that. I think we have routine trials, and the drug companies pay for a large portion of that, is my understanding. I don't know if they would stop them if there weren't other payment or not. I just don't know that.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cisna?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I heard a question before, and I have the question anyway, and that is there, to your knowledge, a way that it would be possible to have the self-insured companies be able to be required to cover something, even though they're not covered, that they're not, whatever, that you don't have any kind of oversight in terms of what they do. Is there a way to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Cisna, that would have to be federal law. That would be federal law. Okay. We're preempted from having any oversight of as a state, I mean, under our state statute. we're preempted by the federal government from having oversight of those groups. So in order to mandate something with them, that would come through federal law. And there are federal laws that do regulate some of the things they do. HIPAA is one of them.
Right.
That applies to those groups. And there are a number of federal laws recently we enacted just so that we can enforce the federal statutes, the mental health parity laws. Those applied to the self-insured groups. I mean, there are things that the federal government passes, and then we will pass into state statutes so that we locally, my division, can regulate those as opposed to having to wait for the Department of Labor to come in and take care of a claim.
Follow up.
So if I understand it correctly, we can't make the law to do that, but we can make a law after the law exists to make it part of your duty. Is that, am I right?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay.
If there's a federal law, the federal government would enforce it. If we then adopt it, we usually only adopt it by reference, and then my division can enforce that federal law.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Keller.
Thank you for taking time to come testify today, Linda. If the Division of Insurance is to learns that I know routine care definition is in question here, but if you determined that the insurance companies were not covering routine care just because it was a patient that was tied up in a clinical trial, does the Division of Insurance, would there be any action, or, I mean, what would you do there?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, it would depend on the terms of the specific insurance contract. We would look at the contract, and what we look for are terms that are clear and unambiguous and make a determination whether there was a specific exclusion in that insurance contract or if there was not. And if there was not a specific exclusion, we would probably get in a debate with that insurer as to whether or not they should be providing the question coverage. We would also suggest to the consumer, if there were not a clear and specific exclusion, that they go through the formal appeals process that's in place both internally and externally.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, at this time, I'm going to close public testimony. Senator, could you please join us?
Been there.
Thank you. Senator, for your information and the information for the committee, Representative Keller has withdrawn Amendment SA.2, but there will be a conceptual amendment offered by the co-chair. But this written amendment has been withdrawn. So you've heard testimony. Any wrap-up comments you want to make before the committee discusses the bill?
The only thing that I have to say is that I'm glad that you had a thorough discussion of this bill, and I wish there had been more time if you needed it to do the research that you want to do. But the one thing that it boils down to is the main concern that I hear that's still debatable in some people's mind is the fact that you're talking about covering only a portion of people in the bill, whereas you have this 23% over here that's not covered because of the federal law plus the earth. But they can, if they want to be a part of that, can choose to have that in their plan, and many of them have already proven that they do have it in the plan. You have a copy of this? And it states in there all these coverages that's there. So we're not just talking about a small amount of people that's covered in the plan and would be covered under this bill. It's a large percentage. It's like 40-some percent, not 20-some percent, you were saying, that's covered. And then the information that you wanted about the standard of care, routine care, you have to have that regardless of what kind of illness that you might have. When you go to a doctor, they establish what would be routine care for that particular disease that they're working with. And so it doesn't matter where you're in a clinical trial or not in one, those things have to be covered by your insurance plan. I don't know exactly where you're trying to go. It seemed like you think in your mind, Representative Wilson, that it only refers to those people that are part of a clinical trial, that it's an additional cost. But they would have that cost whether they were in the plan or not. Do you not understand it that way?
Representative Wilson.
Follow-up care depends upon what you're doing at the time for your care. So if I have cancer and I go through chemo, my routine care based on chemo and how many times I have to go through it, it's designated at that time depending upon if I have to do it for 6 weeks, you know, 5 days a week, whatever happens to be, my routine care will be based on my treatment. So if I go through a clinical trial, whether I'm in, you know, the one getting all the treatment or not, I'm going to be following a routine treatment based on the person getting the real medication, the real diagnosis part of it, even though I might only be getting a small part of that. So my routine care has changed. You know, so it's not like I'm going to have the same number of visits to the doctor, the same amount of blood tests, the same scans being on a routine type of care versus a clinical trial. It changes depending upon the treatment. So we're not talking about the same amount of monies going out.
I'd like to take exception to that and say that it's based upon the diagnosis and not the treatment. And that's my understanding of it. And from what all the doctors have said and what I've read, that would cover that. It's not any different. You're going to pay the routine care where you're in the plan, in the clinical trial, or not in the clinical trial, based upon what they have diagnosed you with. There are certain things that you have, a certain amount of x-rays, a certain amount of blood work, a certain amount of whatever that might be covered, would be covered for you where you were in a clinical trial or not. It wouldn't change because you were in a clinical trial.
Follow up, sir?
Please.
I'm sorry, but that's not true. I've been through cancer treatments with my father, and when he was going through the treatment based on chemo, his regular appointments, his routine was quite different than when they finally got to a point and said there was nothing that could be done. You know, there was, you know, for a purpose of that, then it stretched out longer. Then when he finally went through a stem cell replacement, he then had what they called routine much closer to each other because of that type of treatment. It does change based on what kind of treatment they're doing for the cancer. Because once you get to a point where they can't do anything, there isn't the routine type of it because you've been diagnosed with no type of treatment. So, and I'm not going to debate this back and forth because obviously we have a difference here, you know, but my concern with the bill is I 100% would love to. I have a child right now going through a cancer treatment for a brain tumor. So this has nothing to do with how we feel about cancer, but we're not talking about allowing routine care for everybody who's insured. We're picking out one designated group of private insurance companies and demanding as a state that they have to take care of it, not every insurance company in the state. And that's where I have an issue, where we take one sector and we pull them out and expect them to do something that we don't expect everybody else to do.
Well, in the perfect world, we would want everybody to do it.
Absolutely.
But you have to take it in the phases that you do. And anybody can opt out and have the routine care covered in their plan if they should do it, including the state or any other independent one that you have out there. But we don't want to debate it back and forth like that. You know, you're going to have your opinion. I'm going to have mine. We base the information based upon what we hear from the medical profession, because that's who we have to depend on. And from what they've said, I do believe that they are not asking any more for a person that's in a clinical trial than they would if they were not. You pay the same amount of money. There might be some complications and other things that may be picked up by the pharmaceutical companies or any of the other companies that would be given the money, but I don't think it put a burden on the individual or the insurance company for people to be involved in a clinical trial. And that's the final thing that I have to say. I don't know what the conceptual amendment is. I once more say that I would like to not have any amendments because I'd like for this bill to move forward in its present state so it might have an opportunity to pass this session.
Okay. Thank you. Seeing no other questions of the sponsor, committee will take action. Representative Keller, do you wish to forward your conceptual amendment at this time?
Yeah, I move a conceptual amendment that on page line 12, after the word approved, page 1, line 12, after the word approved, insert phase 2, 3, and 4 clinical trials.
So we have object for discussion. And again, the motion, Butch, is page 1, line 12, after approved, we would insert phases 2, 3, 4 in Roman numerals. And after the word trial, we would change it. We would add S to it, so it's in the plural. Does everyone understand the conceptual amendment offered by Representative Keller?
I don't think the plural is necessary, sir, respectfully. Phase 2, 3, 4, but it's conceptual.
So yeah, yeah. Does everyone understand the amendment? Proposed conceptual amendment? Is your objection maintained?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, before you go any further, are you going to ask him to state what that does?
There is discussion. I see Representative Seaton wants to ask a question, then we'll ask the sponsor of the amendment to address that. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The testimony that I thought we heard earlier on phase one, I'm not really cognizant of the intricacies of these trials. Can we get a definition again of what the phase one trial was? I thought that was safety and efficiency, safety and effectiveness of a drug, not, and that the 2, 3, and 4 were the dosages and interactions and those kind of things, but can we get another explanation of that from the Health and Social Services or someone?
Can I respond?
The Representative Keller, and then if there is, we'll also ask Mr. Obermeyer to comment on it, and if there's anyone else that may wish that's in the room, please, Representative Keller.
Yeah. The definitions of level or phase 1, 2, and 3, and 4 are pretty well, specifically talked about in their guide. What is it? I'm sure it's referred to today, the guide for clinical coverage or something for this. And in a general sense, what it is a phase 1 is the first phase when they take a drug treatment. And it's the first time they try it on a human being. And you got to remember, clinical trials are, by definition, experimental. I mean, that's what they are. They are to refine the details of whether or not a drug should be approved for standard of treatment for a particular disease. So it's when they come up with something that works on animals in a lab, and then in level one, they begin to use small doses in human beings. Now, I'm sure that it's not that simplistic, but that I know that is true. That's where a drug just out of the lab would go, is to a phase one. There may be other phase ones that I don't know. So maybe your question is valid. And I wish I could provide you with those definitions, but they're pretty extensive, and I have read through them. And that was
my okay, thank you, Mr. Representative Keller. We're going to ask Mr. Obermeyer to make his view known, and then I'm going to seek out yet a person that's already testified that may address that. So, Mr. Obermeyer, you please place yourself on the record.
Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. In response to the question about the phase one trials, Representative Keller is largely correct in the definition. There are two in your hearing package. One is in regards to the National Conference of State Legislatures. That gives you the description of phase one as being for 20 to 80 people. Initial stages testing the dosage levels and effectiveness. I think the more persuasive document that I cited in an email the other day was the document signed by the three presidents, medical doctors, and PhDs as well, of the American Association for Cancer Research, American Association of Cancer Institutes, and the American Society of Clinical Oncology. This was a document drafted on December 1st of 2008 when there was some discussion about whether or not Medicare should cover phase one trials. And Medicare does cover phase one trials, and it was explained very carefully in three pages why they do that. That as the world's leading professional and scientific organizations representing oncology cancer professionals, we write to affirm our position that phase one cancer trials are the essential gateway for advancement of new cancer treatments and a vital component of our cancer treatment argumentarium. And they point out on page two, under cancer clinical trials, that they must all have therapeutic intent, that the National Cancer Institute's investigator handbook cites that phase one trials determine safe dose for phase two trials and define acute effects on normal tissues. In addition, these trials examine the agent's pharmacology and may reveal evidence of anti-tumor activity. Therapeutic intent is always present in phase one trials. Indeed, anti-cancer agents are not tested in patients unless preclinical activity studies have demonstrated evidence of significant activity in laboratory models. On page three of this document, it stated that many of the NCI, National Cancer Institute's phase one trials involve agents already approved for the treatment of one type of cancer and are being studied in a different type of cancer in combination with other treatments. As a result, it states, we have some evidence of therapeutic effectiveness that provides solid grounding on which to base therapeutic intent. Indeed, an analysis of 12,000 individuals who participated in 460 NCI-funded phase one trials done in 2005 found that 10.6% of patients experienced an objective response. This number increased to 17.8% of patients when one drug included in the trial was a regimen already approved by the FDA. Furthermore, knowledge of the molecular basis of cancer is allowing us to increasingly develop treatments that are targeted to specific molecular pathways personalized to specific patient populations. That was explained by one of the doctors online. So these are very important trials. They're not random. These percentages that I just cited, I understand from one of the doctors over the weekend, is enough for these drugs to be FDA approved. So many of these drugs that they're using that have come up through the laboratories are very close to FDA approval at that point. And so the increase from 10% to 17.8% when they have FDA approved drugs, I think, shows just how valuable phase one trials are. And this is from the top presidents of the very three largest organizations in the United States regarding cancer, and I don't know what could be better testimony. The Medicare group approved this immediately after they received this. I don't have anything else to provide on phase one trials, but I would hope that an effort to eliminate phase one from this particular bill could be removed, so that for the other reason that I cited in my email is that if we exclude one phase, we are going to create fear among the patients that they will still be denied care in their regular treatments and they won't participate in trials. The statistics that I've cited, that 3% of the 20% that are eligible for trials nationally that don't participate, we are far lower than that in Alaska. And we have almost no people on phase one trials, and it's unlikely we're going to have an awful lot if this bill passes. So I think that putting that in there will discourage participation, which is really the primary intent of this bill, is to get people participating in trials. So that's it's not to just target the insurance industry, because frankly, the insurance industry is going to be dragged back into this under the federal bill in 2014 anyway. We're trying to save lives today and to help the 2,600 new patients each year in Alaska on cancer.
Thank you, Tom. I'm going to ask for one more view on this. And Butch, I'm going to open up public testimony for one more person, and then we're going to move on. Dr. Mary Stewart, are you still available?
Yes, I am here.
Please put yourself back on the record, and if you need, we can have Representative Seaton restate the question unless you've been listening carefully.
I think you'll have the question. I had to see a tape in the last week.
Okay, please put yourself back on the record, state your name and affiliation, and then I'll ask Representative Seaton to ask his question that we've been debating.
My name is Dr. Stewart. I'm a medical in Anchorage. Dr. Stewart,
are you on speakerphone? Because you're breaking up pretty badly.
I can change her app. Is this better?
Yes, very much so. Please put yourself on record, and then I'll ask Representative Seaton to ask you the question. Go ahead.
I think she's trying.
Dr. Stewart, we cannot hear you now.
I'm here.
Okay, state your name and affiliation for the record, and then I'll ask Representative Seaton to ask you the question.
My name is Mary Stewart. I'm a medical oncologist in Anchorage.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have an amendment before us that would remove phase one.
No, phase two, three, and four.
Well, would allow it for phase right. Two and three, four, but would remove phase one from the bill. And I'm trying to figure out the definition and the use of phase one trials and what exactly that means.
Phase one trials are primarily trying to work out the dose or the schedule that a medicine is going to be most effective at. They are often for very new medications that have maybe been through some clinical trials, some animal studies, but they're getting to the point where they're going to be checked in different kinds of cancers.
So, go ahead, please. Finish your comments.
As a practical matter, in Alaska, there actually are very few patients who will be on phase one clinical studies. There are few. There is therapeutic intent. In other words, the point of having these medications out there is to help patients as well as working out the dosing. I also want to say to some Representative Wilson's comments, she seemed to have the idea that there was always going to be a drug that was going to be very profitable for an insurance company. I went through the clinical trials that we actually have open in Anchorage right now, and only very few of them involve new drugs that would make a big profit. Many of them are just drugs that are already out there, trying to check different scheduling. But it is uncommon, actually, for most of the clinical trials that we have available to involve new drugs that are going to be real profitable. There are some, but that's not the rule.
So, Dr. Stewart, in your before I close public testimony, do you support the amendment to drop phase one?
Absolutely not. Phase one studies should be available to Alaska. There are 31 states that have mandated coverage for clinical trials. Only 8 of those don't include phase one. And I don't see any reason why Alaskans should have less availability of studies than people in other states, Nebraska, Iowa. I think we deserve the best.
Thank you. It's intent to close public testimony. Now, Butch, public testimony is closed. Representative, you've received three different views.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, all right. Do you still maintain of your objection, or you wish to comment?
I'd like to comment to my objection, and actually, I realized the thing I had not mentioned before, and that was something that we need to have consideration for is the fact that the number of cancers in Alaska is increasing, and that we didn't used to be first in cancer deaths, but now we are, which there is some real questions about some of the causes of cancer, and the fact that we do have more cancers, and boy, what I've picked up on is a lot of the very unusual cancers we wind up having more of than we ever should when you hear what the incidents are of those cancers. And so I think we should be very much aggressively working at ways to help our state have the tools it needs to protect our citizens, and I think the trials get us there.
Okay, before we go to the vote, Representative Wilson?
On the amendment itself, could you explain, and maybe I missed it, exactly why you took phase one out? What are your concerns about it?
Representative Keller.
Thank you for the question. And actually, I'm going to, if it's with the permission of the chair, I'm going to leap ahead and talk just a little bit about how I'm going to vote on the bill in the end. I don't plan to stand in the way of this bill moving out. But the reason it has tied up in this question, basically, the last thing we need is more government regulations, especially when we're talking about government regulations like this that are messing with the market. Pharmaceutical industry has a lot to gain if they have a successful four-phase process and get an approved treatment. Insurance companies, on the other hand, have nothing to gain and nothing to lose. They just pass the cost on to the customer. And so, in effect, what happens is, if there is an additional cost, and that I realize that question, and it makes me humbly cautious of what I'm going to say, but if there is an additional cost, what we're really doing is helping to pay for the experimental process of approving a drug at FDA. We already do that, by the way. The U.S. government gives a 50% tax credit for two pharmaceutical companies for doing their clinical trials, anything tied with their clinical trials. So the reason I'm putting this in there is that I view phase one as more experimental than easier to put it in that category than phase two, three, and four, because two, three, and four have more to do with the toxicity and the dosages, and the initial dosages are handled, of course, in level one, but it's also in my mind anyway, and I admit that I have limited understanding, but it's more experimental, so that's why I would take out phase one. Also, other states have done that, and I'm not prepared to tell you how many. It's a minority of the bills, the laws, I guess, that have passed in other states exclude level one, but it's just my caution in not wanting to mess with the market when we don't really know the effect. We're talking about the marketplace, how it interacts with the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry, and I just don't want to go there myself. So, and just to me, this reduces the risk of the bill.
Follow up.
Please go ahead.
And do you believe, as we heard, that if we take phase one out of this, that would bring some kind of insecurities or a scare for those who would all of a sudden now think that their insurance wouldn't cover it?
Through the chair.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I'd be guessing, of course. But I haven't heard convincing evidence that at all that the insurance companies are in fact, with all due respect, to the people that look at this from the perspective of the patient, that the pharmaceuticals are, or the insurance companies are, refusing routine care. And I want to say that if I ever saw evidence like that, I would have a different opinion of this bill. And because I think that would be inappropriate to not cover someone's routine care if they're in a clinical trial. That'd be a terrible thing. And I just one last point. I think it's really telling that we have nobody here from the pharmaceutical industry. We have nobody here from the insurance industry. And I don't know what that tells us, but it tells me, you know, it's just interesting to me that, you know, they're not here. They're not speaking on this. So, and I'm just hesitant to move forward.
Thank you. Representative Seaton, briefly, before we vote on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on the amendment, what I heard that most of these drugs are being cross-utilized. In other words, most of them are FDA-approved, and they're being used in a new cancer for which they're not established doses. They can do that right now. I mean, that's legal to cross. An individual doctor can prescribe any FDA-approved medicine, and all the routine care is covered in everything else. And if an individual doctor does that, that's fine. And we're saying that's good, but if you do it in an organized way so that it's publishable, so that the medical community can benefit from that and go to a better treatment, then it's organized and it's called a clinical trial, then we will allow insurance coverage not to cover the routine care, which they would if the doctor simply prescribes it on an individual anecdotal basis. So on the basis of what I've heard and understand on this, and I'm going to vote against the amendment.
Okay. Representative Sissa, your objections maintained?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Butch, roll call vote, please.
Representative Sissa?
No.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative T. Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Seaton?
No.
Co-Chair Keller?
Yes.
Co-Chair Herron?
No. Okay, we have the bill in front of us. Chair will entertain a motion.
I have a question. Can I ask a question?
Questions first, yeah.
You know, we heard about the National Comprehensive Care Guidelines, and for me, I still do not know what routine care is, and if there is something out there that even states it, even if it's not an adopted, but if it's got guidelines in it that we can incorporate in this bill so that it's a little more clear what we're talking about as far as routine care, so we don't end up sticking people between the drug manufacturer and their insurance saying what routine care is. I really need to know that, because I think that might make this bill clearer. I know it would for me, versus saying just that routine care, and I don't know whether it's to, if you would give us time to go look that up and come back today or first thing in the morning. But I think that's information that's the first time I had heard about it, is that there is a definition of routine care that it seems that the doctors themselves go underneath. You know, and I don't know if you want to take, you know, an at ease, and I would be more than happy to go get it. But I think that is information that we need before we go forward with this. At least I do.
Representative Wilson, that as the sponsor stated, it's got a couple more stops before it even gets to the House floor. I would encourage that research be done, and if it's very important, it would be inserted in the Finance Committee.
On that point, but we're, you know, we are the healthcare. I mean, this is why it's in HESS, and you know, not to go with that kind of information to me is part of our duty to make this bill better by being able to designate that. And I just feel, I mean, you know, if you want to move it forward, you can go by this chart we keep talking about. There's still 50% of the people out there insured or not insured or in a program that this won't affect that we're not even talking about here. So I don't think taking a few hours to make sure that we make this bill move in the right direction is a big thing, but that's where I am.
Representative Wilson, I appreciate the comment. Is that though? Is I guess I'm a little concerned that defining a definition in statutes may work against the position, and this is just my opinion, against the position that you're trying to address. I think that the routine care process or procedure, I don't know the correct way of enunciating it, is I think it should be done by professionals in specific diseases or cancers that are in done by people that are studied. And I have a fear that if we were to put a definition, one-size-fits-all definition of routine care in statutes, it may work against your position.
But we heard today that right now there's not an issue as far as we're not getting calls from an office that you would be if people were not having this happen in the first place. I guess my concern is that we could be taking a patient who's already going through a big trauma in their life, as cancer is, and put them in a bad position between their insurance company and the trial. And that's a call that I see that's happening at this point, is that we could actually take something that I'm hearing from the department that it's not a big issue because they're not getting complaints saying they're not, people aren't being covered underneath this. And by putting this forward, we could actually make things harder for the patients, not easier. And I'm personally not willing to take that chance because I know what it's like to go through with a family member with that, and I saw how bad this was for my mom, you know, and then to put her, and she had some of these battles between what the insurance companies wouldn't do, and it had nothing to do with the trials. I'm not comfortable thinking that we may actually put people underneath more stress by this bill, where it seems at this point they're being covered. And to me, that's why we are health and social services, is to make sure we make things better for people, not worse.
Appreciate those comments, and I you bring a good argument, and others on the committee may choose to discuss it, but, you know, in my opinion, that Representative Wilson, is this is, well, it's pretty dang important to me, too, but I think this is a good issue that's extremely finite. It should be done on the floor level, and I look forward to that debate.
Me too. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there's no further discussion, I'd move CS for Senate Bill 10, LS 0073 / SA.
That's correct.
From committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Object.
We have an objection.
I do want to speak to it.
Please.
I plan to remove my objection. I want this bill to move forward, but I just wanted to put a couple things on the record. One is that I think it's already been said pretty well that we aren't sure of the effects of this bill. You know, I mean, I understand the good intentions, and I certainly am not critical of anybody that wants to go there. But the other thing is that, again, the market has a lot to do with healthcare, and I wouldn't bet on the fact that in 2014 this will all be covered just carte blanche like it may appear right now. I think that there is a really rocky road ahead as the amount of regulations over healthcare increases exponentially. And the only reason I mention that is that, again, I would like to say that I would expect and know we will all revisit probably this issue in the future, you know, because it's we don't really know what we're doing. So. With that, I'll remove my objection.
I object.
Okay, we do have an objection. Please, Chief.
And just briefly, again, we're using the small business type of insurance to make a point instead of the self-insured big businesses that can afford to make these changes. That's the wrong way to do things. And we're also taking something that's not a problem, that we've been given any information on that it is, and possibly making it a bigger issue for people out there. And the bill can go forward, and I'm sure it will, but, you know, I don't want the calls to be the opposite coming back, that we now made a big problem for those people who now don't have one.
Thank you. Butch, roll call vote, please.
Representative Holmes?
Yes.
Representative T. Wilson?
No.
Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Sisna?
Yes.
Co-Chair Keller?
Yes.
Co-Chair Heron?
Yes. Okay, the bill's on to the next committee. Let's do a little bit of housekeeping before everybody runs off. We are on the 24-hour rule, and we could meet at any time in the last week. And Butch, for the record, can you put on the record that my wife and grandson have joined us for this meeting? So, thank you.
Oh, hey.
Okay, we're adjourned at...
Wait, hold one more thing, if I could. One more thing on housekeeping. The new health care bill that just came in, one of the things, immediate regulations is coming out, has to do with the high-risk pool. And I will try to get the information to you, but I got information back that our high-risk pool program, ACHEA, or however you say it, has some problems with what the federal criteria is, because we require 6 months of no insurance before the high-risk pool kicks in. So there's a tension there. I don't know where it's going to go. I've been told by the people that are in ACHEA that they don't have enough answers to be able to address this definitively, but I will provide that information to the committee as I get it. And last thing, good job for your family there.
Okay, Butch, Representative Sisna.
Thank you so very much. For Co-Chair Keller, I actually received several letters questioning about some quality questions on ACHEA. So can you kind of include me in this whole discussion about ACHEA? Because we need to make sure that as we head forward, we're doing it in a high quality way.
Well, that's also fine.
Thank you.
Representative Keller, for that, if there is an informational memo that you could give to all committee members, that'd be great.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I hope we were talking about ACHEA, not ACHEA.
Oh, yeah.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This may or may not be the last meeting of the HES committee, but I would just like to express my appreciation to the co-chairs and other members of this committee for some of the spirited discussions we've had and the way this entire HES committee has been conducted. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would like to pass that on as well.
Thank you. Butch, we're up to 10:38, and we're adjourned.